Now, Vince Colonnades.
105.9 FM, WMAL. Hey, good afternoon to you. It's 306 WMAL. Where? That's right, Washington comes to talk. Great to have you with us. Lindsay Watts will be with us from Fox 5 coming up in half an hour for an update on the rise in carjackings, specifically in Montgomery County. We're seeing them all over the place, but she's got an update on Montgomery County, Maryland. Then Congressman Jim Banks joins us at 4 o'clock this afternoon as we examine critical race theory and its role in our military, how the Pentagon shoving indoctrination around the issues of prejudice right into our military. Congressman Jim Banks from Indiana will be here. 4:30, we are joined by a gentleman called Ira Melman from the Federation for American Immigration Reform as these governors down on our southern border decide that they're going to take immigration enforcement into their own hands, having very little assistance from the Biden administration. 5 o'clock, Hans von Spakovsky is here with a breakdown of the Supreme Court's decisions today. A couple of big ones that are worthy of your attention, and he'll get into the details of how the court reached those decisions. And then at 5:15, we're joined by Jennifer Braceras from the Independent Women's Law Center as we examine the way the Biden administration is trying to redefine the term sex. They're trying to redefine the term sex and what it means and how it affects students nationwide under what is referred to as Title IX. Meaning, yes, yet again, we have a packed show for you on yet another busy day and a week ending with Joe Biden having, of course, embarrassed us. Oh, gosh, overseas in Europe in the face of Vladimir Putin. And Putin, as we told you yesterday, playing him like a fiddle, just absolutely dominating him by saying, really, you want to criticize me? Really, American press, you want to criticize me? Human rights violations? What about all of your human rights violations? Ever heard of a little group called Black Lives Matter? Oh, that's right. And then what does Biden do when he's asked about it? He agrees, of course. He's like, or no, actually, what he attempted to say was, oh, it's absurd to make a comparison like that. You know, the Black Lives Matter riots were totally justified. sorry, no, you've handed Putin the weapons that he's now using to attack you. Good job. Way to go. And the weapons he's now using to attack America and to divide us. And those weapons have been propagated by the Democratic Party for some time, and which is why it was interesting to me today to see an interview by Stacey Abrams. Remember, she thinks she's the governor of Georgia still. She thinks she won the election in Georgia and should be the governor. She still maintains that. And the left is all about that. Like, the election was rigged. It was stolen. This is the left that's saying all of this. The election was totally stolen from Stacey Abrams. She should be the governor of Georgia. Well, the reason I bring her up, and the reason I bring up this CNN interview she did today, is because they were interviewing her on their morning show. The host, John Berman, was interviewing her about how Joe Manchin has now offered a proposal that is designed to be an alternative to the Democrats' HR1 package. You know HR1 is that huge overhaul of federal elections nationwide that Democrats, not so quietly, think are going to benefit them in perpetuity. If they can overhaul all the state laws and get rid of all of the election integrity efforts nationwide, then they can guarantee long-lasting power. So they want to push it through, and they want to push it through so desperately that they're begging Joe Manchin to scrap the filibuster to do it. And Manchin, to his credit, up until this point, and by the way, for selfish reasons, because he has a lot of power here, gets to say no. Manchin's like, nope, I'm not going to help you do that. I'm not going to help you get rid of the filibuster. And in fact, I'm not going to support your federal mandates on elections, at least as written. But then this week, Joe Manchin came along and he offered a list of proposed changes to the legislation, a compromise, if you will, that's what he's calling it, to suggest that these are the things that he could do that he thinks could work with Republicans in order to do, once again, this is a federal overhaul of elections. Now, when I say federal overhaul elections, that should tell you exactly how Republicans should think about this. A federal overhaul elections of any kind is not a compromise. It is taking power away from the states, investing it to the federal government, and so that the federal government can dictate the way that all these elections are done. So that's not really a meaningful compromise. So when Manchin's advancing this and saying, oh, it's going to be a big compromise, that's not true. As soon as you say that the federal government is going to exert control over the way these states conduct their elections, not a compromise at all. It's meant to empower the Democrats. But here's what Manchin's suggesting. He wants to make Election Day a public holiday. He wants to mandate 15 consecutive days of early voting for all federal elections, including two weekends. So no more Election Day. These would be election weeks. You'd have several weeks mandated by the federal government. He wants to ban, quote, partisan gerrymandering and use computer models in order to draw congressional districts nationwide. Okay. So if any of us are familiar with big tech and computer models and algorithms, how has that gone in terms of the issues around fairness and bipartisan inclusion? How has that gone in terms of tolerance and diversity of opinion? How are these computer models typically used? Is it neutral? Is it viewpoint neutral? Is it politically neutral? Of course not. It'll come down to who's programming these computer models. What are the inputs? How are they actually constructing this system? And when Democrats claim, including Joe Manchin, that they want to ban partisan gerrymandering, that's almost assuredly a euphemism for, I want to create a specific kind of partisan gerrymandering, the kind of gerrymandering that empowers Democrats. And there's plenty of that across the country, where districts are drawn in such a way. Hello, Maryland. We can look at you. Look at the way Maryland's districts are drawn. They're like a gigantic ink blot test designed to empower Democrats with absurdly drawn districts that involve people who don't have anything in common with one another other than they live in the state of Maryland and they live in the United States of America. But beyond that, all of their needs are disparate. And that's because they live in fundamentally different communities, but not according to the lines and the way they're drawn across the state. And that's drawn, again, to benefit Democrats. So this brand new computer model that Joe Manchin's suggesting we should have, what kind of districts will it spit out? You can almost guarantee they would be more ink blots designed to enhance the Democratic Party's power. Here's one. He wants to require voter ID nationwide. Now, this is where things get interesting. Now, this is what Manchin is holding out as the, well, here's my compromise. Here's what the Democrats can compromise with Republicans on. What if we mandate voter ID nationwide? Now, as a fundamental thing, voter ID for elections in the many states that use them is a good thing. It helps maintain the integrity of the election. The voter can prove who they are using the voter ID. In fact, in Georgia, Stacey Abrams' home state, one of the changes they just passed is, hey, no more signature matching when you send in these ballots. We won't do that anymore. Instead, we'll just have you write your driver's license number on the ballot if you're going to mail it in so that we can match it up with who you are in the system and guarantee that this is actually you. Because signature matching actually is kind of insane to do, isn't it? Because when you send in a signature and then they look at the signature that's on file, you're asking some sort of election worker to become a handwriting expert and then compare those two things and then render a judgment about whether or not your ballot should be included. Well, that's nuts. And guess what that resulted in Georgia last election, the one we just had? Thousands of voters had their ballots thrown out because the signature on the ballot that was submitted didn't match the signature that was in the system, thrown out. Tell me exactly how that helps anybody in a genuine system, in one where we're authentically counting votes. How does that help fair play? It doesn't. It actually opens up an election system to real abuse, where you can have ballots just thrown out willy-nilly because somebody had a hunch that the signatures didn't match. So what Georgia did was say, okay, we're going to make it so that you write your voter ID number, your driver's license number, on these ballots. We'll match it up in the system, and we'll say, okay, that person's registered to vote. Yes, indeed, they are who they say they are. They wrote their driver's license number on it. We're good to go. So Manchin comes along and says, okay, I want to require voter ID. Stipulates this, though. With allowable alternatives, a utility bill, etc., to prove your identity to vote. Now, I'm open-minded about this. If this is a good way to prove that you are who you say you are, go for it. I'm not really sure what the science is on that. It does sound vulnerable once you start carving out stipulations. In reality, like all these states that have said, hey, voter ID is the way to go to make sure that this person is authentically the voter in question, all these states are giving them away for free. They've created no barriers to actually get your ID. Don't have a driver's license, don't have an ID. The state, by and large, will pay for it. They will pay for you to have that because they don't want to have any barrier to you getting the thing you need to prove who you are. right? And study after study after study has been done on this subject, too, on the issue of does voter ID stop minorities specifically from voting? And the answer to that is no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Wherever voter ID has been installed across the country as a prerequisite to vote in order to secure the integrity of the election, it has not resulted in any decrease in minority participation at the polls. None. Despite what you hear from the media. Despite what you hear from the ACLU. The ACLU, to this day, has an entire category on its website where it objects to the idea that voter ID would be used at all in an election. It's prejudice. It's meant to suppress the vote. It's not true. It's just not true. But the lie stays out there. And among the people who have lied about this subject is, you guessed it, Stacey Abrams. Now, Stacey Abrams was asked not too long ago, in April of 2019, about voter ID. She was asked again to sort of like, okay, explain why you think the elections are being rigged. Now, this is Stacey Abrams. Remember, all this stuff about like, well, I can't believe Republican voters would refer to the election as rigged. What about Democrats? Here is Stacey Abrams, one of the chief spokespeople, maybe even the most prominent spokesperson on the issue of elections nationwide for the Democratic Party. Stacey Abrams, in April of 2019, asked about elections being rigged, and listen to her invoke voter ID.
Do you believe that elections are essentially rigged?
What I mean by rigged is this. We have a right to vote in the United States that is afforded to eligible American citizens. But we have seen over the last 20 years a constriction on who has the right to use that right. We have seen it through voter ID laws.
Okay. So we've seen it through voter ID laws. And then she goes on, she lists some other things that she thinks that we've seen this restriction through. But voter ID laws, first and foremost, is the first thing she said. That is restricting people's ability to actually exercise their right to vote. That was Stacey Abrams. Now, that was just 2 years ago. Now, all of a sudden, Joe Manchin comes out with this proposal, once again, to federalize the election rules across the country. And in it, he includes this voter ID stipulation and suggests that this is the compromise. So on CNN this morning, the host, John Berman, asks Stacey Abrams whether or not she's supportive of this Joe Manchin proposal. She says, absolutely. And Berman, as you might expect, hopefully, asks the obvious follow-up. Well, wait a second. You now support voter ID? What's up with that?
You could accept this compromise, what Joe Manchin laid out, even if voter ID was part of it.
That's one of the fallacies of Republican talking points that have been deeply disturbing. No one has ever objected to having to prove who you are to vote.
Did you hear that? Do you feel the gaslighting? Can you smell the gas in the room?
It's been part of our nation's history since the inception of voting.
Wait. So you're telling me that all of this argument that we've had for, you know, God knows how many years now, but in particular, as long as Stacey Abrams has been in the national conversation, that there was never an argument whatsoever? Voter ID was totally fine the whole time? You have no objection to it?
What has been problematic is the type of restrictive ID that we've seen pop up.
Yeah, like
in South
driver's
Dakota,
licenses.
Where Native Americans were told that they had to provide IDs with addresses the state refused to provide. We have states where students are not allowed to use their student IDs, but you can use your gun license.
Yeah, I couldn't use my go-kart ID. There's this local go-kart park where they take your picture when you go in and they say that you're a lifetime member. And they wouldn't let me use that. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. You probably shouldn't use that. You should probably use a state issued ID in this state where you are voting. And there, again, are zero barriers to you getting that ID. And additionally, almost everyone in question is even involved in voting has an ID anyway, and it's deeply patronizing to pretend like they didn't in the first place. But pay no attention to that. The only point that jumps out off the page, for obvious reasons, is now Stacey Abrams is saying, that was a Republican talking point. We've never been opposed to voter ID. Just amazing. And she can just turn on a dime. She could be like, oh, yeah, I was for voter ID the whole time. Everybody was. What are you talking about? As they try and push this Manchin thing through. And you know what this is really about. They want Republicans to oppose this and then give Joe Manchin the predicate to come along and say, it's time to end the filibuster. Look how reasonable I was, Joe Manchin will be able to say. I presented a compromise. I even include voter ID in it. Of course, like reasonable, sensible Republicans are going to respond, well, wait a second, no, stop nationalizing the election. Stop taking federal control of our election process and encourage the states to adopt voter ID laws. If you think voter ID laws are good to go, if we all agree now, if Stacey Abrams herself is on board, Stacey, baby, get together with me. You and I will film an ad and we'll encourage every state in the country to pass voter ID laws. You're for it now. You just told me it's a tradition as old as the country itself. As long as people have been voting, Stacey Abrams said, they've been proving who they are. Good. Let's do it. I'm down to create the ad.
Now, Vince Colonnades.
Hey, good afternoon. 3:35 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. You a big fan of smart guests? Good. We've got a lot of them today. 4 o'clock, Jim Banks will join us, congressman from Indiana, going after the way that our military is being propagandized. 4:30, we have Ira Melman joining us from the Foundation for American Federation, that is, for American immigration reform, as some of these Republican governors on the border try and get control of the border. Hans von Spakovsky is here from the Heritage Foundation at 5 o'clock as we get into these Supreme Court rulings today, a couple of big decisions coming out. And then Jennifer Braceros will join us from the Independent Women's Law Center at 5:15. We'll make that a legal block for you as we get into the way the Biden administration is changing the definition of sex. Pretty interesting topic and a lot of meaning for the lives of you and your children. But first, I want to focus on an issue that's affecting us locally. All over the area, we've seen this, especially inside the District of Columbia and in certain areas around the district, a rise in carjackings, a meaningful rise in carjackings going on. And the reporting I'd like to share with you now comes to us from Montgomery County, specifically comes to us from Fox 5 and its great reporter, Lindsay Watts, who joins me on the phone. Lindsay, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Hey, Vince. Good to be here.
Montgomery County having a surge in carjackings, you are reporting this week. Tell us what you know.
Yeah, the assistant chief of police told me this is something that is unprecedented, this rise in carjackings that they're seeing. And some of the trends, he says that a lot of these suspects are 16 and younger, so young kids. And this is something that's really striking to me. They're not seeing these stolen cars being chopped for parts or shipped overseas or sold. They're saying a lot of times these kids are taking them for a joyride and then ditching them. A lot of times the cars are found in D.C. And this is similar to what we've heard from other police departments around the region. We've talked to D.C. police. We've talked to Prince George's County police. They are also seeing very significant spikes in carjackings. And this trend seems to be pervasive throughout the region.
They're just stealing the cars for kicks. I mean, this sounds kind of dystopian. It's like, you know, like kind of like a free for all world where, remember that game Grand Theft Auto, where like the point of the game was essentially to do this? Like the fun of it was like you beat somebody out of their car, you jump in the vehicle, you drive off. It's like a real video game that's existed for some time. They've made like, what, 5 or 6 of them. Now we're seeing it in real life. These young kids, you said under 16. Is there a reason that it's people who are that young? Is it just that their peer group finds this to be thrilling?
You know, the assistant chief was saying that he's seeing some young people sharing tactics over social media. And then, of course, you know, in the last year, some kids weren't taking part in school because they weren't physically at school. And so my hope, because I've been covering this now for almost a full year, this rise in carjackings throughout the region. And so I was hoping that when things were starting to go more back to normal, that we'd see this start to finally die down. And unfortunately, that's not what's happening. And it's definitely alarming. It's something where personally, I really keep this in mind as I'm driving and as I'm parking. And I have started to really be aware of this because you're starting to see how this can happen anywhere. And some of these cases that I've seen are just, they're so upsetting. There was the case in D.C. that is absolutely haunting, where the Uber Eats driver, two teen girls stole his car. He hung on to it and he was tossed to the sidewalk and killed. One of the most horrifying videos that I've ever seen. And just thinking about it, it makes you emotional. But because I think that he had the reaction so many of us would have when someone's trying to take something that's yours, of course, your car,
yes.
You want to fight back and you want to do everything you can to hang on to it. But I think people need to remember that your life is more important than any of your property.
Yes.
If you find yourself in this situation, but you know, just lock your car. You have to lock it. And even if you're standing right outside your car and the engine is running, you, of course, you think no one's going to pull up and take your car. They will do it. And we are seeing it happen again and again in broad daylight. Somebody standing right there. Somebody just drives up. And it can take, you know, 10 seconds or less for someone to see that your car is there idling. You know, somebody's driving a car. Second person hops out, takes your car, and it's gone.
So these are crimes of opportunity, what you're describing. And
absolutely.
Are we seeing like hot wiring cars still a normal thing? Or is this one of those things where people are jumping into running vehicles and taking them?
Yeah, we're not really hearing about the hot wiring. It's very much, like you said, crimes of opportunity and the jump in. Because so many people, too, are going in to grab food from restaurants, and they're still doing this, even though you can sit in restaurants now, and the food delivery drivers are running in, and they're grabbing stuff. And, you know, if it's only going to be a quick run-in, you know,
yes.
You leave the car running, save yourself a few minutes. And so there's an overwhelming number of these cases where people are jumping in the cars and taking off. So it wouldn't be technically a carjacking in that case.
Right.
But just because I knew I was coming on, I pulled some stolen vehicle numbers as well. And just did a little math, and in D.C., PG, and Montgomery County, there have been over 3,000 cars stolen just for the first, you know, not even 6 months of this year.
So
across the region, we're seeing this.
Okay, so I mean, I just have so many questions about this. So one is like the kids who steal these cars, 16 and under, you said it seems like they're doing it for the thrill. They must be trying to impress their friends. Are they posting some of this to like social media when they do it too?
That I have not personally seen, and I haven't heard about that from police. And usually, you know, if they were going to be doing it, especially sharing it publicly, that
right.
kind of stuff inevitably would take off and you would see it. You know, one thing that comes to mind, there was a big one from last year where this man was in his car. He was sitting there and he was doing a Facebook Live broadcast. And as he is there speaking, you see these guys come around. They hold him at gunpoint, pull him out of the car. They drive off. So the Facebook live stream is still going. And so you see these guys as they are stealing his car and speeding away, beeping their horn. And that was really alarming because you just watched the whole thing play out. And, you know, people who are watching his Facebook live watch this all play out as well.
It's totally brazen. So typically, you kind of think about, like, the reason people commit crimes like this is because I guess they think that, like, there's not a meaningful consequence on the other end. Like, even if they do get in trouble, they'll be able to get away with it. What is the truth about that? What are the jurisdictions in our region doing when it comes to carjackings, especially by teenagers?
What's really unfortunate and can be so challenging in these juvenile cases is it can be very hard to get information. But we know from following the that Uber Eats driver who was actually, he was killed as these girls stole his car. We know in D.C., these girls were in juvenile court. And what we learned is that the maximum penalty for a juvenile, at least in D.C., is you can be locked away in a juvenile facility until the age of 21. And that's the maximum penalty you can get. So these girls, obviously, it was a much bigger crime than just stealing a car, right? Because this man was killed in the process. But I know in talking to police, it's a concern for them that in some cases, these kids could be getting out very quickly and reoffending. And I have heard from police that they have seen that happen, where they arrest a juvenile for stealing a car, and then they are back out doing it again, arrested for the same crime. And we do see these repeat offenders, where in some cases there just aren't strong penalties where these kids are being held.
Is anybody trying to fix any of this? Because it feels like a horrible status quo that we're in the midst of right now. Because, you know, not only will have we already seen people get killed like that Uber Eats driver, Mohammed Anwar, but also you got to imagine that at some point these children, these teenagers are going to carjack the wrong person. And that would mean dead teenagers in the street. It's hard for me to see how this is good for anybody. Are any public policy officials in our area seriously trying to create something new to stop this, including by enabling cops to enforce the law?
Police have been trying to work together in our neighboring jurisdictions here, and the feds have even gotten involved because of the level that this has risen to. So as far as I know, they are trying to do what they can to combat this, but I think that's about as far as it goes.
Yeah, it seems really bad. Well, thank you for tracking this. I really hope you stay on. I know you have. You've already said that. You've been following it for the last year pretty aggressively. And Lindsay Watts, you know, we'd love to have you back as you get more updates on this. And hopefully the next time we have you, it's because the numbers are improving and the carjacks are going down. That would be nice.
I hope so. It hasn't happened yet. And I would tell people, please just make sure you are locking your cars.
Yeah, it seems like good advice. Thank you, Lindsay Watts. I appreciate that. From Fox 5.
Good to be here.
I've got Sam calling in from Alexandria. Sam, you said this is something that has happened to your wife. Hello.
Yeah, and it wasn't a carjacking. What happened was she had her purse, as I think do most ladies, and it seems like in talking to the cops around Alexandria and interstate interchanges, happens quite frequently, is they will spot a car and with somebody filling up, and they will sneak up to the passenger side door, pull it open, grab the purse, jump in a car, and go. In my particular case, she borrowed my truck, which is a little bit higher, so she didn't notice the people coming up beside the vehicle, whereas, you know, she's pretty vigilant when it comes to those kinds of things. And I think the takeaway is not only lock your cars, but stay off your phone. Remember, they target especially gas stations because they know people are not paying attention, and ladies generally leave their purse in the passenger seat.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, good advice. You know what's horrible about all this? I mean, besides the fact that it's occurring, the reason it seems to be occurring is because of the utter leniency of government officials in the face of it. So, you know, as Lindsay Watts was just describing, you've got, you know, an Uber Eats driver who was murdered by two teenagers in Washington, D.C., pretty famously. The whole nation got to see that video. Horrific. The guy dies, and then the girl is only going to serve prison time until she's 21 years old. Very, very short amount of time. It's virtually a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that we heard from the officer that responded, he actually chased them. They jumped on a 495, immediately went over the Wilson Bridge into Maryland, and he had told us that they were looking for these guys because they had done the same exact thing a mile up the road into Alexandria. And when the wife gave chase on foot, which is her, just the way she is, after the car, they saw it skidding out into the road and taking off on the interstate. And they tried to catch them, but they said when the speeds exceeded 100 miles an hour at that time, they had to just back off because of public safety. But, they're brazen, and this is a method that they are using in this area especially.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Sam. It is disturbing, and, you know, I'm disappointed that you don't have government officials beating down the door at Fox 5, for instance, as we talk to Lindsay Watts, and she's explaining, yeah, I've been looking into all these carjackings, and I'm reporting on this rise in carjackings. It doesn't seem to be going down. It's only getting worse around our area. And you would think some public official who would like to be reelected would have some courage and would be approaching Fox 5 or WMAL or any of these local news outlets to say, hey, I'm doing something about this. Hey, I'm working to enable the cops. Hey, I'm working to make sure that we give penalties that actually serve as deterrents from these types of crimes happening again. I'm working to make sure that prosecutors are actually doing the job instead of just dismissing these cases and refusing to take them up or coming up with some gross explanation for, well, you know, we have to look at the circumstances for why that person stole that car. You know, maybe they were struggling. Maybe they really needed that car. You know, and this is the kind of nonsense that you get from people who are supposed to be enforcing the law and prosecuting the people who break it. And when those systems don't work together, ask the cops. Ask the cops who make arrests and then have prosecutors who don't support them. What does that do to morale, and what does that do to the likeliness that that officer will pursue that perpetrator? What does it do to the likeliness that that officer will arrest that perpetrator. If the end game is all they have to do is a lot of paperwork and there will be no prosecution and that person's back on the street and they can do it again. And that's what we're stuck with. Have you seen the video out of San Francisco of the CVS this week? Wild video out of San Francisco. In San Francisco, they have a law that it is not a felony to shoplift if the amount of product you steal is under $850. And CVS has this policy apparently of like, you can't confront the shoplifters or whatever. Just, you know, I want to keep everybody safe. So that toxic brew of things has created, there are viral videos. There's a guy filling a garbage bag with product inside of a CVS, literally just filling up the garbage bag. He's on his bicycle inside the store, sets the garbage bag on the handlebars, rides right out the door. And the security guard has like this like feckless effort where he like takes his hand and he shoves the bag on the way up. But that's it. So what is going on in America? Is our public officials, are the people that we've tasked with being in charge, have decided that this is okay, that they're on the side of criminality, that they're on the side of making our communities less safe. And we're seeing the end results of that now here in our area, unfortunately. So how about a little courage from the people who are holding elective office? It's hard for me to imagine that anybody of any party wants their community to be more violent. I thought we could at least agree on that. You know, carjackings, that's a bad thing. I want my kid to be able to walk to school successfully, get there safely, to go to the grocery store, be safe, want to be able to park my car and not fear that I'll be carjacked. That's not really a partisan consideration, not really a Republican or a Democrat thing. It's just a common sense thing. You need a safe community. And yet, look at what we've been dealt. 351.
Breaking news. The inside story on Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It was a Walgreens in San Francisco, the video I was describing. Man fills up a trash bag with goods, puts it on the handlebars of a bicycle inside the store, drives right out of the store. Nobody stops him. And the city lets him go, too. They just bust him, you know, it's a misdemeanor. As long as you steal less than, it's $950. That's what it is. There was a Proposition 47. It was a referendum. San Francisco voted for this. They made it a misdemeanor to steal everything, so people are doing it. They took them up on it. In fact, the Walgreens stores in San Francisco are robbed so much that Walgreens says that of the 53 stores they have in the city, the theft at those stores is four times as much as any other place in the country. So they're constantly getting ransacked. Amazing. Amazing. And then in our area, we've got a huge rash of carjackings that are going on, including in Montgomery County, as Fox 5's Lindsay Watts just broke down for us. That carjackings just getting out of control, and many of the people who are doing it, young teenagers, people who aren't even driving age. In Maryland, you've got to be 16 and a half to start driving. Under 16, most of the people committing carjackings, and it makes people scared. They go out in their cars, and they get very concerned, get nervous about just being in public. And that's not good for a community either, just getting everybody's nerves all heightened. Let's get Wayne and Olney in here. Wayne, good afternoon.
You say this isn't a partisan issue. You say this isn't a Democrat or Republican issue. I disagree with you. Do you think if there were a bunch of politicians in charge that were like of Ted Cruz, say, that we would have this problem? Let me tell you what the problem is. The problem is you've had a bunch of useful idiots voting for Democrats for the past 50 years. No matter how incompetent, downright evil that political party becomes, it's a cult. And the problems we have, just about every problem in this country, you can point to Democratic Party voters. So don't tell me that these uneducated bunch of juvenile delinquents, educated by Democrats because of Democrat voters, don't tell me it's not a partisan issue. And by the way, don't have someone call up and complain about Republicans because Republicans would conservative, you know, good Republicans if people would stop being such brainwashed idiots and voting for Democrats, no matter how radical this party becomes. I've never seen anything like it. People that are otherwise good people never break the law, yet they go out there every 2 years. They think they're so politically savvy,
yeah,
and they vote for these radical leftists.
Totally.
I've never seen anything like it.
You and I agree. I hope you don't think we disagree. My view is that it should not be a partisan issue, keeping your family safe.
It is.
And
I just explained how it is.
Yeah, I know. Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And it should not be in any way. It's not a disagreement in policy. It's not one of those things. It's like you just got to keep the family safe. You have to have a safe community. And yet, to Wayne's point, leaders in the Democratic Party have so abused this system and think that they derive power from the destruction that they've wrought that among the voters, people need to open their eyes. That's the key. Realize what you're voting for. And then when we say elections have consequences, look outside. Maybe observe the carjackings happening in your neighborhood. It's 4 o'clock.
Now, Vince Colonnades.
Hey, good afternoon to you. 406 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Coming up, Ira Melman will join us from the Federation for American Immigration Reform as Republican governors look to secure the border. That'll be at 4:35 that we speak to Ira. At 5 o'clock, Hans von Spakovsky is here with a breakdown of a bunch of Supreme Court rulings today. And then at 5:15, we talk about the changing definition of the word sex. That's right. The Biden administration trying to do that. Jennifer Braceras will join us from the Independent Women's Law Center to explain. I am Vince Colonnades here on the Vince Colonnades Show, talking about changing definitions and the types of things our government is talking about. Take a listen to a conversation I had this week between a member of Congress, Jim Banks, and the chief of naval operations. The question, why is the Navy recommending that its sailors read a book by a guy who wants to reintroduce prejudice to America?
Admiral, Kendi's book states that capitalism is essentially racist. And Kendi is clear that racism must be eliminated. So yes or no? Do you personally consider advocating for the destruction of American capitalism to be extremist?
Here's what I know, Congressman.
So yes
There's
or no
racism
question,
racism in the United States Navy.
Admiral, you recommended every sailor in the United States Navy read this book. So yes or no question.
I'm not forcing anybody to read the book. It's on a recommended reading list.
Admiral, did you read the book?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah. Admiral Michael Gilday, the chief of naval operations, being questioned by Congressman Jim Banks of Indiana, who joins us now on the phone. Congressman Banks, good to have you with us.
Hey, Vince. Good to be with you.
What is going on with the United States military right now?
Well, that's a good question, Vince. I mean, at the end of the day, for the highest-ranking admiral in the United States Navy to put out a reading list. By the way, I served in the Navy. I used to get this reading list. I used to read books that were on the CNO's reading list. But for him to push out a book that inherently preaches critical race theory, a book that is written by an author, Ibram X. Kendi, who believes that that capitalism is fundamentally racist. He attacked Amy Coney Barrett for saying that she was a white colonizer because she adopted two children from Central America. I mean, the book goes on. The book says that all of America is racist, inherently evil, and you have the highest-ranking admiral in the United States Navy endorsing this book and pushing it out to sailors. It's hard for me to understand what that does to help our retention, our morale, our recruitment into the Navy, and those are the questions, Vince, that I ask the admiral this week, and as you can tell, he didn't have a good answer for it.
No, he just tried to weasel his way out of all of your questions. And one of the things that you brought up is that Kendi apparently at one point had suggested that white people had created AIDS. This is a conspiracy theory, had invented AIDS. And you asked the admiral to account for that. Like, really? This is the guy whose work you're promoting? And he didn't have an answer for you.
Well, the reason I asked him that question, because Ibram X. Kendi did say that when he was, it's been a few years when he came out with this sort of extremist conspiracy view on white people creating AIDS, creating the AIDS epidemic. The reason I asked the admiral was, is that an extremist view? Is because the Navy just underwent something called a stand down to root out extremism in the ranks in the United States Navy. So this question is relevant. Are you saying that? Do you believe that that Ibram X. Kendi and his views are extremist or not? He wouldn't answer it, but let me tell you, Vince. Almost every week, I hear from a sailor, from soldiers, airmen, Marines, others serving in the United States military, who, because they've posted something conservative on Facebook or they've said something on the right, they've been sought out or even in some cases punished by the United States military for extremist views. So are you telling me that it's extreme to be a Trump supporter, to have views on the right, but it's not extreme to espouse some of the views that Ibram X. Kendi espouses, which you've endorsed by putting his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, which is a racist book, on the reading list for all the sailors to read?
Congressman Banks, I mean, being a veteran and thinking about your time in service, my view has always been, I grew up a military brat. I grew up in a Marine Corps household, lived in a lot of bases, and knew a lot of guys in the military. A lot of my friends were their children. And the one thing that I realized about that experience is that it's one of the most highly integrated sectors of our entire society, ethnically. I mean, there's people from all walks of life, all types of wealth, all types of religious backgrounds, all types of ethnic diversity. And the just sort of those differences, by and large, are completely de-emphasized because they have this shared purpose in the military. It seems to me that these efforts by the Chief of Naval Operations and broadly by the Secretary of Defense and the Biden administration only serve to, like, elevate race consciousness as the most important thing in the military. And I cannot see how that does anything but actually create divisions, not resolve them.
No, you've said it well. It's counterproductive. It doesn't help us accomplish the purpose of making the Navy stronger, mightier, more focused on the adversaries that we face. Instead, it divides us. And that's why I wrote the letter to Admiral Gilday a couple of months ago and asked him, why did you put this book on your list, on the reading list? It took him a while to respond to me. I actually had to go on Tucker Carlson's TV show and talk about it to get the admiral's attention. He responded to me a day or two after I was able to go on television and talk about it on a widely viewed TV show. So he did respond to me and said, I'm keeping the book on the list. Doesn't mean I endorse everything in the book. But all the things that you heard him say very defensively in the committee hearing is basically the gist of his response to me by letter. But I'm still baffled by why he would support the book, put it on a reading list to begin with. But it does tell you more broadly that this administration, the Biden administration, because I don't think this was Admiral Gilday's, ultimately, I don't think this was his decision. I think this was brought about from the secretary, from even the president, his senior leadership themselves, to push critical race theory into all of the tentacles of the federal government. But let me suggest to you right now, Vince, there's nowhere that's more dangerous to push critical race theory, maybe other than our schools, than into our military, which, as you put, the most diverse experience I've ever had in my life was serving in the Navy with people from all backgrounds, all ethnicities, all walks of life that I served with in the Navy. I mean, it was inherently it was a very diverse experience. And to push this garbage out and tell sailors that they are racist, to tell sailors that the that America is racist, that the Navy is racist, I don't know how you go out and recruit the next generation of young men and women leaders to raise their right hand and take an oath and potentially put on a uniform and die for their country if at the same time you're endorsing an ideology that tells them that America is evil and not worth fighting for.
In fact, you know, for Admiral Gilday to suggest, like, well, I just want people to appreciate all viewpoints, so I'm including some sort of diverse viewpoint, that suggests, like, is it typical for the Chief of Naval Operations to recommend books that are antithetical to the American project? Like, so would you put the Communist Manifesto on the the recommended reading list for the Chief of Naval Operations?
Yeah, of course not. And a book like this has never been put on the reading list before. I mean, the reading list is about what you would find on the CNO, the highest ranking admiral on the United States Navy's reading list, pushed out to United States sailors to read, are books about leadership, books about character, perhaps books about geopolitical issues that relate to the adversaries that we face abroad. That's what the CNO's reading list has always been about, until this CNO politicized it and endorsed a book that preaches an ideology that is un-American.
Right. Yeah. And the point is to figure out how to confront the enemies we have, not to create new ones within our own ranks. Thank you very much, Congressman. Very good to talk to you, Jim Banks, and look forward to doing that again soon.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. You too. The United States Supreme Court out with a couple decisions today. Not close ones. New York Times with the report. Affordable Care Act survives latest Supreme Court challenge. This was the one wrapped up in the fact that the individual mandate was zeroed out. Remember, during the Trump years, they got rid of the penalty. So no more individual mandate. It's still the mandate's still there, but there's no penalty if you fail to get health insurance. And the idea was like, well, look, because that was considered a tax in the first place, Justice John Roberts used that as the pretext to basically say, yep, the Affordable Care Act can keep going on. Now, we'll get all of the legal breakdown of this at 5 o'clock when we talk to Hans von Spakovsky. He's an expert on all of this. But here's what they're saying. It's a 7-2 vote. The New York Times, of course, you can't, you read the New York Times and like everything is about how Republicans are the worst. First paragraph. It turned aside the latest effort by Republicans to kill the health care law. Okay. The legislation, President Barack Obama's defining domestic legacy, has been the subject of relentless Republican hostility. Notice that they're still not telling us the news. This is still about Republicans pouncing. But attempts in Congress to repeal it have failed, as did two earlier Supreme Court challenges in 2012 and 2015. With the passing years, the law gained popularity and became woven into the fabric of the health care system, says Adam Liptak, writing for The Times. On Thursday, in what Justice Samuel Alito Jr. called in dissent the, quote, third installment in our epic Affordable Care Act trilogy, the Supreme Court again sustained the law. Its future now seems secure, and its potency as a political issue for Republicans reduced. It's The Times. Now, it was a 7-2 vote, as I mentioned. The reason for all of this is a technicality. The justices essentially determined that the people who brought the case didn't have standing. So they didn't really rule on the specifics of the law other than to say, well, sorry, you really don't have standing to bring the case. And so that's where this law falls down. It was the plaintiffs, two individuals in 18 different states. They sought to basically say, hey, look, when John Roberts said that the individual mandate is a tax, and that's why Congress can pass this constitutionally. All right, we'll challenge that because Congress got rid of the penalty in 2017 under Trump. And so it can no longer be justified as a tax. This is not a part of the Congress's taxing authority anymore because Congress got rid of that, quote, tax. And so that's what they wanted to use. But the court, including a bunch of the conservatives on the court, said, sorry, No bueno, and you do not have standing here. Even Justice Clarence Thomas joining in on that side of the fight, saying regarding the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever the act's dubious history in this court, that's Justice Thomas saying he disagrees with the old Obamacare decisions that they've made upholding the law. Quote, we must assess the current suit on its own terms, and here there is a fundamental problem with the arguments advanced by the plaintiffs in attacking the act. They have not identified any unlawful action that has injured them. Today's result is thus not the consequence of the court once again rescuing the act, rescuing Obamacare, but rather of us adjudicating the particular claims the plaintiffs chose to bring. In other words, they weren't damaged personally by this. They don't have standing, and so they're out. That's what Justice Thomas said. So and he took some shots, as you can see there, at the prior decisions that the court has made, Justice Roberts made, in upholding Obamacare and saying that Congress had the right to do this. Clearly, Thomas saying, oh, no, they didn't. But that's not what this law, that's not what today's case was about. The other part is this Supreme Court decision today on a Catholic adoption agency in Philadelphia. Philadelphia cannot stop a Catholic agency that arranges foster arrangements for foster parents. When they screen foster parents, the Catholic agency said, well, we don't send children to homes of same-sex couples. It's just against our religion. But what we will do is we'll recommend another service. So if you want to find a foster service that'll work with a same-sex couple, we will recommend a place to go. But we're just not going to do that. That violates our faith. And this became a case that did wind its way to the Supreme Court. And guess how many justices sided with the Catholic agency? All of them. All nine of the justices now today siding with the Catholic adoption agency and saying, this is a big deal, it seems like, that they're you know, emphasizing the preeminence of the First Amendment. They do have a First Amendment right to practice their religion and not have it infringed upon by the government. Again, Hans von Spakovsky will sort through these decisions for us today, but I do think it's a big deal that you get all nine justices on that side of that issue because, you know, it seems like at least today a win for common sense. And again, that agency not saying same-sex couples can't adopt anybody, can't have a foster parenting arrangement. They just said, we'll just recommend somewhere else you can go to do that. It won't be through us. And so those are the two big cases out of the Supreme Court today. Hans joins us at 5 o'clock, just a half hour away. We'll get the details with him. Got a bunch of Republican governors that are deciding to take matters into their own hands and get control of the United States border. Governor Greg Abbott yesterday announcing a $250 million down payment to complete construction of the border wall and every inch they can possibly manage in Texas. So they work on the arrangements there. They're going to allocate this money through the Texas Department of Criminal Justice into a disaster account, they say. And then the Texas Facilities Commission for the border wall construction, they've got a real plan here. And they're also taking donations at this website called borderwall.texas.gov. They're trying to crowdsource the funding here to build a wall along the southern border. Also, Ron DeSantis announcing yesterday that he's going to be supporting both Arizona and Texas and sending Florida's law enforcement, sending the cops to go help the overstretched border patrol, the overstretched state troopers in those states, and give them some more assistance keeping an eye on the border as not only people but vast quantities of drugs pour across. Also, of course, you know, you've got the president and the vice president failing to visit at all, and it's gotten the attention of not just Republicans, but Congressman Cuellar, Democrat from Texas, Congressman Henry Cuellar, has had this to say. He was just interviewed in the last 24 hours about Kamala Harris not visiting the border. He is now sending her an official invitation. He needs to get her there. He wants both the president and the vice president to visit. This is a House Democrat. Listen.
You have said that for the president and for the vice president, it's really not about a staged visit to the border. You want them spending time with the people there, with law enforcement, elected leaders, business owners, to better understand what's happening in your backyard. Tell us why experiencing this in person is so important to you.
You know, when you live there day to day, you see the dynamics of the border. It's a very dynamic part of the United States. It's a beautiful place to live, but at the same time, there are some challenges, and challenges are that first, you have border restrictions for non-essentials. So folks from Mexico are not coming in, the ones that spend over $19 billion in the U.S. But then at the same time, people in my community see people coming in and are being released at bus stations or being released at NGOs or at the airports. Some of them are not vaccinated. So they see this contradiction of certain people that come in and shop and spend money in the U.S. Can't come in, but then you see non-documented people coming in. It's important for the vice president or the president to come visit the border just to hear. They don't have to hear from me, but just hear from my community so they can understand.
Sorry, Congressman. They don't care. They have no interest. Maybe Cuellar should become a Republican. Send a message that way, because the rest of his party does not care at all. It's 4:30.
Now, Vince Colonnades. 105.9
FM, WMAL. Hey, good afternoon to you. 4:37 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Coming up, 5 o'clock, Hans von Spakovsky will talk about the Supreme Court's decisions today, a couple of big ones. And then Jennifer Braceras joins us coming up at 5:20, make that, as we talk about the way the federal government is redefining the word sex. That's right, they changed the definition before our very eyes and the impact it's going to have on your kids. It's a big deal, worth focusing on. Speaking of the genders, the sexes, you see this move by Victoria's Secret, this publicity stunt by Victoria's Secret to say they're abandoning the angels. They want to swap out the Victoria's Secret angels for what women really want. I don't know. I thought women just wanted to look good. I thought the kind of the whole deal with Victoria's Secret was, oh yeah, look how beautiful they look. I want to buy that product because it'll make me feel beautiful. Isn't that kind of like marketing throughout history? As long as we've had marketing, it's like, oh, I want to live that idealized life. Remember the old Axe body spray commercials? I don't know if they still do this. I don't think they do it anymore. But it used to be that, like, it would be if you spray Axe on you, like, women would just swamp you. Like, no matter where you go, women would just be attaching themselves to you. I think in one of the commercials, they recycled an Axe can and they turned it into, like, a pipe inside of a building. And the woman couldn't get away from the pipe. She was, like, so attracted to the pipe because it used to be made of an Axe can, you see. So the whole, it was all preposterous, but the idea was like, look how sexy you can be if you use this product. And people bought it. Like, all of a sudden, it was a great idea. The company that runs Axe, makes Axe, is called Unilever. They sold a ton of it, became one of the most popular, you know, male body sprays in the country. Everybody was buying it. Young guys were buying it because the marketing was kind of convincing. Well, that's kind of been Victoria's Secret deal too, right? Where it's like you get like women who are like interested in the product, like, oh, look, the people think they're sexy. I could be sexy too. I could wear this. I'll feel good. I'll feel confident about myself. Men like it too, and women see that men like it. Pretty typical thing. No, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to abandon that. Victoria's Secret says they're swapping the angels for what women really want. And guess what women really want? They want to see soccer star Megan Rapinoe be the face of Victoria's Secret now. Megan Rapinoe, who's like kind of routinely complained about how oppressed she is, that she's suffering, that she doesn't make enough money, she's never been paid as well as the male soccer stars, never mind the revenues that go into male soccer globally versus women's soccer, don't pay any attention to the details. It's just all very unfair. She's oppressed. She's really got it rough too, you know? And now she's got to struggle being the face of Victoria's Secret. What a tragedy for this woman. It's been a disaster for her. And so Victoria's Secret, which was kind of rescued, actually, when they decided to turn it into a sexy product line and they created the Victoria's Secret fashion show and began becoming this like global phenomenon, selling the products that way, is now deciding that they're going to abandon it. They say they want to get rid of the, quote, Jessica Rabbit curves, which epitomized a certain widely accepted stereotype of femininity. This is the New York Times writing. They say now they're going to, quote, advocate for female empowerment. And I guess the question for me is like, okay, whatever. This is a product move. It's designed to sell products. Their fundamental goal is that they're a business that wants to sell products. Is this going to work? Is this going to work? I mean, this is the move towards like, well, we want real women to wear the underwear, and that's how we're going to depict it in the advertising. And we're going to show you this is what a real woman looks like wearing this. It'll make people feel comfortable. Is that going to work? And were women really offended by the Victoria's Secret fashion show? Were they really offended by all of this? You know, one of the things that I've seen Megan Rapinoe and company saying about this is that they're very concerned about the male gaze. Have you heard this phrase? We shouldn't be building all these products around the male gaze. And they make it seem like men are just like leering at everybody. Just like, it's the worst thing ever for a man to stare at a woman in any capacity. What an animal that guy is. Is this going to change anything? Is this going to be a successful business model? Or is this just, you know, the sort of typical woke virtue signaling nonsense that as you're watching a company that's already in decline, throwing a Hail Mary. What do you think? 888-630-9625, 888-630-WMAL. The company, Victoria's Secret, they have over $5 billion in annual sales. 32,000 people work for them, nearly 1,400 stores worldwide. And now they're going to have to make this pretty radical change. That's what they're claiming they're doing. Getting rid of the Barbie bodies, they say, and the wings, and the rhinestones, and the diamonds, and the feathers. It's all disappearing. They say in their place are going to be seven women famous for their achievements and not their proportions, including Megan Rapinoe, the 35-year-old pink-haired soccer star and gender equity campaigner, Eileen Gu, a 17-year-old Chinese-American freestyle skier, soon to be Olympian. The 29-year-old biracial model and inclusivity advocate Paloma Elsesser, who is the rare size 14 woman on the cover of Vogue. And Priyanka Chopra Jonas, a 38-year-old Indian actor and tech investor. So the point is, we're going to abandon beauty. We're going to focus on brains and achievement in other fields. Okay, that's fine, but you're selling underwear. Am I wrong here? Isn't the point that you want to convince people that they're going to look good in this product? Donna and Frederick, what do you think of this change?
Oh, my goodness. I'm a longtime customer. I'm not embarrassed or afraid to say so. I've always loved their product line. They have beautiful lingerie. There's no doubt about it. And I've been married a very long time, so maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But all that being said, why not keep the angels? Why not just introduce the plus girls and the diverse girls in the same mix? Why do they have to totally abandon ship, if so to speak? I think they're sinking their own boat on this one. They're just going to become just like everybody else. And it's a stupid, politically correct move on their part. Very bad business decision.
And Donna, what's with the whole trend towards saying that it's awful that anybody would be a male fantasy? Like, they're upset that men fantasize at all. They seem pretty grumpy about it.
They hate natural law. That's the difference. Men are naturally attracted to women. They have a problem with that.
Yes, they seem to.
There's something wrong.
Donna, thank you for reminding me I'm not crazy. I appreciate that. 444. It's actually been a couple years since they've done the Victoria's Secret fashion show, too. They started winding it down. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. They didn't do one. The cool thing about that event is, it was not one of those stuck-up fashion shows. There was nothing stuck-up about it. It was the girls were having a great time. It was they love the products so much. One of the headlines here, which is true, is that the angels were, quote, absurdly hot. That's what Slate writes. Yeah, that was the point. They hired beautiful women to represent the product, and, of course, people got interested in the product as a result. But maybe that marketing doesn't work anymore. Maybe things have changed in that way. But Victoria's Secret making a pretty radical change here. Dave in Alexandria. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, Vince. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Good. I look at it this way. Now, Omar, Presley, and especially Elizabeth Liawatha Warren now have backup employment plans when they lose.
Yeah, no judgment here. Whatever you want to look like. Yeah, thank you, Dave. So that's Dave. Look at Dave being helpful. He's trying to offer some other ideas. Keep people employed. Thank you, Dave. Speaking of being employed, Caroline, you once worked for Victoria's Secret. Tell us about that. Hi.
Yes, I did. I was a manager with them for a number of years in several states, actually. And I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed working for the company. It was demanding. They had very strict standards, very strict display standards, which is an area where I was very strong. I enjoyed that.
Right.
But something that people didn't understand is Victoria's Secret was there to support women in other ways as an employee of the company. Should you find yourself in a difficult domestic situation, there was support there in the form of counseling. They would help you relocate. I had one woman who was in an abusive situation, and Victoria's Secret arranged for her to immediately relocate to another area. She was, her relocation was kept confidential. She was offered counseling and went ahead and kept a career, last I heard, with Victoria's Secret. So it certainly has been there for women. It was not all about just looking, ridiculously sexy, but it had a share of the market.
Yeah.
It's not intended for everyone. Not everyone wants to shop there. Not everyone wants to pay for a Brooks Brothers suit. Nobody it's a portion of the market. And I think to do this, to try and just jump on and make it something else, I think it loses its identity. And I don't think there's anything wrong with looking feminine, obviously, since I was employed with them for a number of years. But this is just just it's trying to match the political climate at this time.
No
and
question.
I think it's a little shame. Nothing wrong with them being intelligent at all.
What sticks out to me, and I just want to see if you think this way too. What sticks out to me is like they kind of distinguished themselves, right? They made themselves like the fun, sexy, flirty plays with these absurdly hot women who were the angels. And in other words, like they had a brand identity that was unique. It stuck out and everyone kind of knew it. And now what I'm seeing them do is like, hey, we want to be another boring underwear company. And it's hard for me to see how that's a useful business proposition.
I don't know. You're exactly right. They're going to be like someone else. And you went there because they were different, because you could get something a little more fun.
Right.
They had color stories. When I worked with them, their display was very intricate, very set, very specific. Now they really don't do the windows anymore, which I took as a shame. They stopped doing that after I left the company. But yeah, were you just going to sell them in, you know, Ziploc bags, buy a six pack now, just like, you know, other stores? And that's not really the point. And sometimes it's fun to just go in there and see what there is. And yes, you do feel feminine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And as I said, it's a little bit of a misconception, because the women there, we were trained. They did appreciate educated, well-spoken women. When I was there, we dressed appropriately, and, you know, no one was just sexy and stupid or something, if that's sort of what they're trying to say they're getting away from. It really was not like that working for the company. It really wasn't.
Interesting. Thank you, Caroline. I appreciate that call. I am thinking a little bit about one other thing that might be at play here. Remember the last time Victoria's Secret was in the news for a big reason? You know what it was, right? Jeffrey Epstein. The Epstein story has been very much strapped to the name Victoria's Secret over the past few years, because of his relationship with the billionaire Les Wexner, who was very close to Jeffrey Epstein. And there are a lot of questions like, wait a second, why is Epstein like managing this guy's billions? Like, why does he have his hands in the money here? Epstein, a convicted pedophile who died in a prison in New York in uncertain circumstances. What the heck happened there? I mean, maybe Victoria's Secret is looking to spin out of all the bad press they've been getting out of one name being strapped to them lately. That would be Jeffrey Epstein. Just a theory. 454.
Washington's Mall, 105.9 FM, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
You know, earlier this week when reporters were waiting for Joe Biden to arrive at the summit with Vladimir Putin, they were joking that they were going to ask questions. You can hear him on the hot microphone. They wanted to ask questions about Hunter. Specifically, where's Hunter? That was a joke, by the way. They didn't actually ask anything about Hunter Biden, although they should. But they won't. They thought it was hilarious, though, that one of them might do it. But they probably should ask some questions about Hunter Biden. You see the latest Hunter Biden news? Hunter Biden has been referring to Asian women as, prepare yourselves, yellow. In a January 2019 text message to his cousin, who was asking him about the type of women he preferred. We should probably keep Hunter away from the Victoria's Secret stores. Let's just set that up first. The text came from Hunter's abandoned laptop. It was revealed on Wednesday by the British newspaper The Daily Mail, which also provided a screenshot of the message. It was Caroline Biden, the daughter of President Joe Biden's brother James, was talking to her cousin Hunter about setting him up with her friends. Do you want foreign or domestic? I can't give you bleeping Asian. Sorry, she said. Hunter replied, domesticated foreigner is fine, no yellow. Oh, the Biden family. You see, they're the tolerant ones. They're so high-minded. 459.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Now, Vince Colonnades. 105.9 FM,
WMAL. Hey, good afternoon to you. 506 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. Great to have you with us. We got a couple Supreme Court decisions today. One on Obamacare. Did it survive? And one on adoption policies and whether or not a Catholic foster agency can deny couples on the basis of LGBT status. And, you know, it's a couple big decisions today. I want to break them all down with our next guest, Hans von Spakovsky, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and former commissioner for the Federal Election Commission, former counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Justice Department as well. He's done it all. Hans, hello, sir. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Vince, it's great to talk to you, although it's kind of weird because it's not so early in the morning, so I'm not drinking coffee while I talk to you.
Yeah, I'm just trying to keep you guessing, that's all. Thanks, Hans, very much for joining me. You've got an Affordable Care Act case. In fact, I think you and I have actually talked about this case a bunch, which went before the United States Supreme Court, and it was all based on the individual mandate. I guess in 2017, when Republicans successfully zeroed out the individual mandate, the plaintiffs in this case said, well, then the taxing authority that the Supreme Court relied on in order to say that Obamacare was constitutional is no longer there anymore. So isn't the law unconstitutional? What happened today?
I think the majority of the court actually took they wimped out and took an easy route out, because instead of dealing with that substantive issue, instead, they dismissed the case saying that Texas and the other states who sued didn't have standing to sue. In other words, they said they couldn't show any injuries caused by Obamacare remaining in place. I think that is just completely and totally wrong. It was a 7-2 decision. And the two dissenting justices, Alito and Gorsuch, I think they actually got it right when they said, well, of course the states have standing to sue, because the rest of the act, the entire Obamacare, it can't be severed from the mandate. The mandate was the reason that the court before said it was constitutional. And I, like I said, I think they got it right, the two dissenters. I think the rest of the court just was wrong about it. The states not having standing.
Is it possible to have to basically say you have standing because your freedoms are damaged? So, for instance, like the law, while the individual mandate's penalty does no longer exist, it's been zeroed out, the law still mandates that you have health insurance. Now, there's no actual punishment if you fail to get it, but the law is really clear. It's like you have to have health insurance, and if you don't do it, you're in violation of the law. Isn't that itself the kind of thing that is damaging you if your liberty is threatened?
Well, the court didn't think so, because in fact it said that the individual plaintiffs lack standing because the mandate is now unenforceable against them. So if somebody doesn't buy insurance the way the law says you're supposed to, nothing can be done about it. You can't be prosecuted for it. A penalty can't be imposed. So the court viewed that and said, nope, no injury, no standing.
Are you surprised, like, Justice Thomas was in the majority for this case?
Well, I was. He actually agreed with the two dissenters about how the mandate is central to the constitutionally the whole act.
Right.
He went, though, with the rest, because he said that the states had not made the standing claim that Alito advanced earlier. In other words, they should have raised that issue and they didn't in the case. So
interesting.
I think that's a technicality that was not quite correct. Like I said, I think the two dissenters got it exactly right.
Yeah, 6-3 decision there. Now, there's another big story today involving a unanimous decision. The United States Supreme Court unanimously ruling that Philadelphia can't stop a Catholic foster agency that refused to work with same-sex couples from screening those parents out of its program. That Catholic agency saying, look, this violates our religious conscience, will refer same-sex couples to other agencies and said, hey, we'll send you somewhere else where they will work with you. We just can't do it because we're a Catholic agency. The Supreme Court, interestingly, standing with that Catholic agency, Hans, why did they do that? Yeah. Why did all 9 justices do that?
Well, because they say that it violated the First Amendment's free exercise clause by Catholic social services, and that the state could not show a compelling interest in enforcing this provision against the Catholic social services, because they didn't show that. Because remember, the interest of the city is in maximizing the number of foster parents, and by getting rid of Catholic Social Services, which has been providing these services for decades. In fact, they were going to be providing less foster parents for the many children that need them. So this was actually a good decision. And the only slight dissent was from Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, who said, yeah, this is the right holding, but we don't think the court went far enough. That they wanted the court to actually overrule an earlier case called Smith, which they thought was actually too severe in this area. They thought the court should have gone further to protect religious freedom.
In fact, so what are the implications? Are there broader precedents set here? You think about a case like this, you think about the case of Masterpiece Cake Shop, right, where you get a cake owner who decides, hey, I don't want to bake a cake for a gay wedding. It's against my religious. In fact, I think he didn't even want to mark the cake for it. I think that was what it came down to. It goes against his religion. Are there any broader precedents set here by the court's decision today?
This case and this court decision, 9-0, this is a warning shot across the bow of local governments, county governments and city governments and state governments who across the nation who are trying to punish individuals like the cake shop owner, organizations like Catholic Social Services, simply because they don't go along with the current, political orthodoxy about same-sex marriage. And those local and county governments, they cannot violate the religious rights of organizations and individuals, as they have been doing now for a couple of years.
It's funny. I saw the New York Times coverage of this decision today has the following sentence in its coverage. It says, quote, "The decision in the latest clash between anti-discrimination principles and claims of conscience was a setback for gay rights and further evidence that religious groups almost always prevail in the current court." Now, when a New York Times writer writes that, the implication is that because Republicans have meddled with the court, that the religious groups are prevailing. Hans, this was a unanimous decision. The composition of the court apparently played no role, actually. It was 9-0 every justice.
Yeah, and in fact, what the court was doing was preventing discrimination. I mean, it's the exact opposite of what the New York Times said. They just don't want to acknowledge that because in their minds, discriminating on the basis of religious belief, that's okay with them. I mean, they think that ought to be that provision of the First Amendment ought to be written out of the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, that obviously pretty obvious from the way they covered that. Hans von Spakovsky, thank you as always. Great to talk to you, including in the afternoon. Appreciate that, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Washington's Mall, 105.9 FM, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Department of Education made an announcement this week, yesterday, that transgender students are protected under Title IX. They say the law prohibits sex-based discrimination, it does, in federally funded schools. They want to change the definition of sex to include what the left often refers to as actually the definition of gender. If you ask sort of the average transgender activist through the years, are sex and gender the same thing? They'll say no, that they're not, that they're two distinct things. Your biological sex is the thing that the doctor knows instantly when you're born. Your gender, though, that's a spectrum. That's a completely different thing. But not according to the Biden administration, no. The protections designed to protect women under Title IX will now be exploited to basically supplant women, to say that, the people who identify as women can take the positions that women would have taken. Amazing. For more on this, we bring in our next guest. Her name's Jennifer Berceris, director of the Independent Women's Law Center, on the phone now. Jennifer, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How meaningful is this change to Title IX?
It's extremely meaningful. When Title IX was passed, it had a very clear purpose to protect women and girls from discrimination and to expand opportunities for them in the educational arena. Nobody at that time thought that the word sex meant gender or gender identity. Everybody understood what the law was trying to do. And this is really a radical rewriting of law and language in the United States.
Right. So, I think most conservatives who come at this issue are like, look, gender and sex is the same thing. They're interchangeable terms. But the left has had this position for a while that these are two distinct things. So it seems like they're abandoning even their own rules here, because the law doesn't say gender. It says sex very specifically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's meant to protect women. And what you have now is a blurring of the law and the language specifically to make it so that, for instance, biological men can compete now in women's sports inside of these colleges and universities.
Right. I mean, a couple of things to unpack there. I think, first of all, gender and sex have come to be used interchangeably in common parlance. So my teenage kids would say gender discrimination, what they really mean is sex discrimination. And to the public at large, it means the same thing. It never meant the same thing in academic literature or in, you know, scientific literature or in legal terms. And, you know, I think there's actually a scene in the movie, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie, On the Basis of Sex, where she's arguing a sex discrimination case, and she writes this brief, and throughout the brief she says sex discrimination, and her secretary comes to her at one point and says, you know, Ruth, I really think you ought to change the word to gender, because when you say sex all the time, it's going to be really distracting to the male judges on the bench. Now, I don't know if this actually happened or not, if this is completely apocryphal, but it does sort of represent what happened in our society, which is that people were squeamish with the word sex to mean biology, and so they started saying gender all the time. And as a result, they handed the left this sort of victory where they've now been able to redefine legally what it means to be female.
What a fascinating – thank you for that. That was what a fascinating history of that. And it does feel like what's happened here is that language is being meaningfully manipulated, specifically in a world where the language really matters. Like when you write a law and you use the word sex, it has a very specific term. So what is the impact going to be now that the Biden administration says that they aren't going to make a distinction between those two terms, and that anyone who's considered transgender is thus protected under Title IX?
Right. So what it means is that biological men will have an opportunity to try out for and compete on women's sports teams. It means they'll have an opportunity to receive scholarships that are intended to increase the participation of girls and women in STEM, and they will be able to take all sorts of opportunities away from women and girls. Now, what the Biden administration would say is, we just want to prevent discrimination, unfair discrimination against these people. And nobody, of course, is arguing that a transgender high school kid should be denied his education because you know, he or she is struggling with his gender identity or because they're transgender. Nobody believes
right.
that. But the administration, what they're using the language of discrimination when what they're really doing is asking for an accommodation, right? They're not saying schools can't discriminate against transgender people. We all agree with that. But that's not what the activists are asking for. They're asking for spots on the team and seats at the table that belong to biological women.
Yes, they're asking to discriminate against women. That's what they're asking for. And that is
correct.
The impact of this. This is also, I know a number of states have introduced bills, and some of them have passed successfully laws that would ban men, biological men who identify as women, mm-hmm. as transgender women, from playing sports at colleges across the country. Is this the Biden administration's attempt to go to war with those states?
It is. And those laws, I would say, are complicated because each of those bills are different. And I wish that what they did was focus on on athletics at the university and college level. But unfortunately, most of our politicians are too afraid of the NCAA, and they're too afraid of woke capitalism boycotting their states and not hosting collegiate-level events. So unfortunately, what some of these laws have done is banned it, you know, at the K through 12 level, which really, you know, does anybody really care if a transgender kid is playing soccer on a, you know, whatever, on a first grade soccer team? No, not really. I mean, individual communities can figure out how to accommodate people without there being laws about it. Where this is really significant is where scholarships and roster spots come into play at major universities. That's when you're taking opportunities away from girls, and arguably at the high school varsity level as well. So unfortunately, I think some of these bills are not well drafted, but to answer your question, yes, this is the Biden administration's attempt to supersede state-level attempts to protect women's sports.
Every so often, I think I just want to jump into a time machine and go back and then tell, like, a feminist from decades ago, like, hey, the end product of your work is biological men will be the winners. Like, what? How does that work exactly? Thank you so much, Jennifer Braceras. Great to have you from the Independent Women's Law Center.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Take care.
Good to talk to you. Just laughing, looking at the Lori Lightfoot story, you know, that email she sent to her staff. Have you seen it? It was just over and over and over again, like a psychopath. She just kept writing the same sentence. I need office time every day. I need office time every day. I need office time every day. Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. Okay, crazy person. I mean, it's straight out of The Shining. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Over and over and over. It's great. We're not sending our best. I think that's the summary of that. Also, speaking of sending people, did you see that not every woman in the Senate wanted to go to Kamala Harris's house for dinner earlier this week? Kamala Harris, the vice president, holding a dinner at the Naval Observatory for the women of the Senate. It was attended by 22 senators, 16 Democrats, 8 Republicans all showed up. 2 Republicans declined. Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi and Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming said, nah, no thanks, not going to be there. One Democrat also saying, I'm not interested. Thanks, but no thanks. Kyrsten Sinema, yet again, causing trouble for the left. This time, not showing up to Kamala Harris's dinner. And she even made cheese puffs. 5:30.
Now, Vince Colonnades.
Good afternoon, 5:36 WMAL, where Washington comes to talk. What else are those governors doing down south? Here's Governor Ron DeSantis yesterday. He's pardoning all of the people who got busted for COVID violations, gym owners, all sorts of things, were being hassled by their local community for not following the restrictions closely enough. DeSantis said, yeah, whatever, I'll just pardon them all.
This action is necessary so that we can recover, have a good transition to normal operations, and also just a recognition that a lot of this stuff was way, way overboard. Accordingly, I hereby move for the categorical remissions of all such fines.
Yeah, there you go. He's getting rid of them. Good for him. Good for him. Did the Attilus Gym guys get that in New Jersey? I don't think they did. I don't think Phil Murphy up there in New Jersey is on their side at all. I like that they went to war with them, though. And they got hit hard for it. Fined every single day for saying, nope, we're going to stay open. We're going to stay open. We're going to keep our business going. We'll keep people safe. And they did. There was no spread there. People just kept on working out, staying healthy throughout the pandemic. And the state of New Jersey wanted to crush them. But in Florida, DeSantis said, no, we're gonna pardon everybody here, and we're going to get them out of these penalties that are trying to suffocate them. And one of the places he did was a Broward County gym owner. DeSantis said that the conviction of this guy, Mike Carnevale, this Broward County gym owner, was a total overreach. The gym owner was arrested 3 times in August last year for disobeying the county's rules by not requiring customers to wear masks at the gym. You know, you're on the treadmill, just trying to get your run in for the day, and you're suffocating on your mask. The gym owner's like saying, you don't have to wear them. Just run, buddy. It's fine. It's fine. And so they were punished by one of the counties down there in Florida, and the governor said, no, we'll give him a pardon. We'll take care of that guy. Carnevale saying yesterday, it's really amazing that Governor Ron DeSantis has granted us clemency for this. It's just affirmation that, you know, we were on to something. And so there you go, a win for some liberty. In fact, here he is pardoning the gym owners.
What we're going to do is anybody that's similarly situated, that has been either criminally charged or prosecuted for any type of nonviolent offense related to COVID restrictions and these emergency orders. We just want to say, you know, we've got to stop that. You know, let's focus on the real criminals, and let's make sure that that's where our effort is.
Yeah, there you go. Also, let's see what else happened. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has signed a law banning the government from closing churches. No more of that happening in Texas. The law says you can't close places of worship anymore. It started as Texas's HB 1239. It prohibits, quote, any elected or appointed officer, employee, or agent of the state from closing a building or grounds where religious activities are conducted. This new law follows an executive order that Abbott had already issued last year that shut down Texas. Remember, Abbott did shut down houses of worship. Now he's saying, no, we're not going to do that again. And now it's officially a law in Texas. One of those things where you're like, wait a second, like, why do they need a law? They've got the Constitution. Apparently didn't work. Wasn't enough. So just to really reemphasize the point, Texas has a law that goes along with the First Amendment. Now, Abbott tweeting about this, obviously, he's doing the right thing now. But remember, he did pass that executive order that had closed houses of worship last year. I just signed a law that prohibits any government agency or public official from issuing an order that closes places of worship, Abbott says. The First Amendment right to freedom of religion shall never be infringed, other than when I did that before, but that's over now, so hopefully never again. What else? We've also got, you see that the scientists who are now saying that we should look into the lab leak theory are now admitting that the reason they didn't look into the lab leak theory, or at least didn't express it out loud, is because they didn't want to seem like they supported Trump. What an abysmal state of affairs. What a pathetic group of losers here, that they would go into this and say, you know what, we're going to abandon the thing that we supposedly have been building our career towards, the scientific method, skepticism, testing the facts, testing hypotheses, figuring out what's true based on, you know, subjecting that hypothesis to rigorous testing over and over and over. That's not what they did. They just said, we're not going to talk about this because Trump believes in it. They abandon it. This is an article that was in NBC. The headline, "The Science Around the Lab Leak Theory Hasn't Changed, but Here's Why Some Scientists Have." Huh. And here's what they say. "The shift reflects how some scientists who previously avoided the topic or were quick to dismiss it are grappling with enduring uncertainties about the virus's origin, free from the politicization that clouded such discussions under the Trump administration." What a bunch of snowflakes. Oh, the politics, it really threw me off course. I wasn't able to do science anymore. I was so disoriented. One of the scientists, last name Chan, who's quoted here, said there had been trepidation among some scientists about publicly discussing the lab leak hypothesis for fear that their words could be misconstrued or used to bolster racist rhetoric about how the coronavirus emerged. Trump fueled accusations that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a research lab in the same city where the first COVID-19 cases were reported, was connected to the outbreak, and on numerous occasions called the pathogen the, quote, Wuhan virus, or, quote, Kung flu. At the time, it was scarier to be associated with Trump and to become a tool for racists, so people didn't want to publicly call for an investigation into the lab origins, she said. Do you hear what the downsides are to racializing everything? Turns out the downsides are to national security. The downsides are people die because you're insane. And I can't help but also think about the United States military as I think about this comparison. We were just talking about it a bit ago with Congressman Jim Banks. The way that the Pentagon, the Defense Department, has so thoroughly racialized everything. Its communications, its conversations among troops, its attempts to get the troops to actually elevate their racial consciousness. That is, when I say that, that's not a good thing. That's a bad thing. That's when you focus first and foremost on the color of somebody's skin and not the content of their character. Not the way that they can serve alongside you and support you. Not the way you can serve alongside them and support them. But instead, elevating immutable characteristics and make everyone obsess over those things. If you do it in science, you do it in the military, and you do it in something that involves national security, it turns out the lesson is people get killed. And it makes us harder to stop things like that in the first place. Again, 544.
People forget that. But if you go back then, even though you lean towards feeling that this is more likely a natural occurrence, we always felt that you've got to keep an open mind. All of us. We didn't get up and start announcing it, but we've always said keep an open mind and continue to look. So I think it's a bit of a distortion to say that we deliberately suppress that.
What? There were you remember last year the number of headlines that were that emphasized that Anthony Fauci had come out and destroyed the lab leak theory and Donald Trump's conspiracy theory is gone and Tom Cotton's conspiracy theory is nonsense. That's Anthony Fauci this week insisting, well, we were always open-minded about where it could have possibly come from, despite the fact that, again, he told National Geographic last year that he doesn't even entertain that theory. That somebody had found it in the wild and brought it into a lab and that it had accidentally escaped. Oh, no, no. It was just natural. That's what he said last year. Now he wants. Now he's trying to convince you that, oh, no, I was always open to all the possibilities. Don't look at me. Phil in Fredericksburg. We're looking at you. Hello, Phil. Go ahead, sir. Phil, you there? Going once. Going twice. Hello, Phil. Yeah, he's not there. It's too bad. He wanted to talk about Wuhan and his point, the point I'm staring at the screen. He said, it's a shame how many people died because of their ineptness. That is true. It is a shame. It's a disaster. Speaking of people dying, the issue of abortion, which nobody in Washington seems to talk about all that often, it came up today. When Nancy Pelosi was asked a deeply uncomfortable question, it was the kind of question. My jaw dropped just hearing a reporter ask it out loud. You don't usually hear anybody ask about, like, hey, when do you consider a baby to be real? Like, when is it a human life? Pretty core question, right? A reporter actually asked Pelosi today. Listen to her dodge.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I'm with CNS News. The Supreme Court this fall will review a Mississippi law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Is an unborn baby at 15 weeks a human being?
Good question.
Let me just say that I am a big supporter of Roe v. Wade. I am a mother of 5 children in 6 years. I think I have some standing on this issue as to respecting a woman's right to choose.
Is it a human being?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
She moved on. Do you hear that? She didn't even answer the question. I've had babies, and therefore I have standing, and that's it. All right, next question. Like, no, actually, you didn't answer the question at all. And good for that reporter for asking it again. Wait a second. Is it a human being? 15 weeks. Is that a human being to you? Catholic Nancy Pelosi? Is that a human being to you? 15 weeks? She's like, well, I've had children. Okay. She dodges on that. Josh Hawley this week had a good moment, too, in the United States Senate. He was praising an abortion survivor named Melissa Odin. She was testifying yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee. About her experience. And Josh Hawley compared the evils of abortion to the evils of slavery. Don't often hear lawmakers willing to say something like that. Take a listen.
More than anything else, I just wanted to be here today to give you a chance to share a little bit of your story and just to bear witness to it and to bear witness to your struggle to make sure that every person in this country is welcome and wanted and protected by the law. And as you said, your rights don't change about what stage of birth you're in or not. Your rights don't change based on whether or not someone anticipated you were coming or not. Your rights don't change because you look differently from other people. But your rights are who you are because you are a person and they were given to you by God. And I just think as we look back in our history, you think of the abolitionists who for decades and decades and decades fought against the moral evil of slavery, fought it when it was the majority position of the country, fought it when they were told that they were crazy, fought it because they knew that there was a moral truth that every person is created equal and has equal rights, and they were willing to fight for that in our country. That's what you're fighting for. That's what pro-lifers are fighting for, is that great moral principle. And I look forward to the day when we look back and say, how could abortion ever have been allowed in this country? How could we ever have allowed innocent unborn life to be taken in the womb? And I think because of you, that day is coming. And we'll look back and say that you expanded our own moral understanding and you made this country a better place. So thank you so much for what you're doing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, God willing, that future is in play. The woman he was talking to, Melissa Odin, she survived a horrific series of circumstances. Her mother attempted to abort her. And when she was born, there was a debate over whether or not they were going to let her die right there on the operating table. And a nurse jumped in and saved her life. And now she's testifying before Congress. 554.
Breaking news. The inside story on Washington's Mall. WMAL. Where Washington comes to talk.
A little bit of drama starting up again in Loudoun County. We're going to get into this a little bit more tomorrow, but the Democratic Party in Loudoun County is planning on now busing in people from not even from the county, from all over the place, to Tuesday's Loudoun County School Board meeting in order to support the Loudoun County School Board and to fight the parents in Loudoun County. You got this? They're sending mailers around, emails around now, even a tweet in the last 24 hours or 48 hours. They say they're joining alongside community organizations, activists, educators, and elected officials to stand up for, quote, love and equality. They want to fight back against the parents. They're going to hold a big event at the Loudoun County School Board meeting. Wow, things are about to get interesting in Loudoun. That's Tuesday night. We'll be tracking it all right here on WMAL. Up next, the great one, Mark Levin.